housekeeping details that I needed to
Just
send.
a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Okay, so we know that. Okay, good. So I'm going to be talking with Doug Brookman. Doug Brookman is a mediator, facilitator, and trainer who has been conducting collaborative planning and various kinds of problem-solving processes really full-time for 20 years. And he has his own firm based in Baltimore called Public Solutions. His background is that he earned a master's degree in public affairs from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. And for a while, he worked for the Texas State Legislature as director of the Senate Finance Committee. That sounds like a very difficult and challenging position. And he, in that position, he noted kind of the inefficiency which is inherently a part of the adversarial nature of the legislative process. And then he discovered mediation, and he was really interested and took a mediation training. He did some community mediation for a time and also used his mediation principles as he continued to work with the legislature. But then he started his own firm, Public Solutions, in 1989 and continued it even as he and his wife moved to Baltimore, which is really a challenge to start your own firm and then have to start it up again in effect in a new geographic location. He currently offers facilitation and a broad range of conflict services for private and federal sector clients at the intersection of energy, environment, and public policy. And let me just say that I will be asking Doug some questions initially, and then we will open it up to any of you who have questions to ask as well. So let's go ahead. Doug, can you talk a little bit about your job at the Texas State Legislature, which is where you were when you first became interested in negotiation and collaboration?
Sure. I'm glad to do that. First of all, thanks to everyone on the phone for joining us. I'm happy to make this call, and I thought Howard Gedlin's call, the last one, was very informative. I hope I can do as well. I had really two jobs at the Texas State Legislature, and my first was shortly after graduate school. I served as a staff member for a rather prominent state senator, and he was a very talented guy. But what I would say is that legislatures are just a fascinating little microcosm of conflict. You get to observe, if you're looking carefully, the full range between profoundly adversarial, beat the other guy up kind of stuff, and more nuanced, effective collaboration. And it happens in committees, and it happens in back rooms, and it happens in bars, and it happens all over the place. So it really is quite a an educational opportunity for someone who's paying attention. And what I observed, not only in that first job as a legislative aide, but also as director of the Senate Finance Committee, and I should back up to say, the unfortunate thing that happened when I was the director was that oil prices went to $10 a barrel, and it was a huge difficulty for the state of Texas. We recorded a huge budget deficit, perhaps the largest budget deficit recorded by a state in modern times, percentage-wise. And so it was a couple of very difficult years of cutting budgets and raising taxes. In that activity, I got to see the very best and the very worst from everybody involved in the Texas legislature. And what I observed over and over was that when a major issue failed, when it didn't come together as it might have, then what was lacking was essentially capable facilitation. And especially what I saw over and over was there were plenty of good ideas, there was frequently sufficient resources and energy, sometimes time was short, but what happened typically was that there was no one that took possession of a process that was going to usher a solution from A to Z. And so I observed this over and over, and I thought to myself, I think there's a real need for this, and in fact, I think there's a business in it.
Aha! So that occurred to you back then that there might be a business in it.
Yeah, I thought there was such a need for it that in some way, some shape or form, whether in the legislature or other places, that it was a service that was valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, how did you first hear about mediation or any other form of a formalized alternative dispute resolution during that period?
Well, in graduate school, I really studied mostly macroeconomics, and so I was very familiar with all of the kind of multilateral negotiations that go on in the trade spectrum and other kinds of fora around the world. So negotiation as a concept is new to me, was not new to me. But while I was in the Texas legislature as a staffer, the state of Texas was under federal court supervision for its entire basic education program. That K through 12 in the state of Texas was had been challenged in court and found to be unfair in terms of the funding. So that was a big problem, mm-hmm. and it really affected the way the legislature could deal with one of its biggest expenses, education. And in that period of time, I was able to hire Jim Lowy, became a mentor of mine, formerly a professor at the Conflict Clinic at George Mason University, who I believe then was one of the best mediators or interveners in the country. And so I got to work with him on this project, and observing Jim and how he did the work and helping him to shape the way it all came together. I thought again to myself, this is very valuable, and I got to watch a really talented practitioner up close, and so it gave me some confidence that if I worked really hard that maybe I could do that work also.
Uh-huh. How did you find out about Jim Lowy?
I scouted around. I made a couple dozen telephone calls, and I prevailed upon people who didn't know me at all to tell me who the best in the country was.
That sounds like you, Doug. For those who don't know him, Doug is a real researcher. If he wants to know about something, he just reads and gathers information until he knows as much as he can get his hands on. That's really one of your wonderful strengths, Doug.
Well, thank you. Well, we're all profoundly ignorant. We all do the best we can.
So after that, where and when did you take your first mediation or ADR training, and what was it like?
So after that stint as a legislative staffer, I found I discovered mediation as a process or modality, and I got trained at the Austin Center for Dispute Resolution, which is a really, really fine program back then. And I've been gone from Austin 20 years. I don't know whether it's still going strong, but it was Austin, Texas, a rather liberal, forward-thinking town in the center of Texas, had this wonderful program going, and a few folks that are very well known nationally, particularly Mary Thompson and her co-trainer, partner in this effort, Judy Corder, were some of the original trainers and organizers of that center. So I got a lot of good training. I continued to take training wherever I could, and then very quickly, in the span of less than 2 years, I was able to do a lot of cases, at least, say, 75 to 100 cases. So I got a lot of experience doing a lot of different things.
Were those neighborhood disputes or broader than that?
Well, all kinds of disputes. Business disputes, family disputes, community disputes, juvenile restitution, barking dogs. Pretty broad range. I think the only thing that I didn't do, and that most mediators that receive these court, many of these were court referred, didn't do any sort of property settlement or anything like that. But I got to experience a pretty full range of different, mostly two-party disputes.
Uh-huh. And how did you like it?
Well, I learned a lot. And I liked it a lot. What I observed in that context, and it was mostly a co-mediation format, was that parties, no matter where they start out, no matter how angry, no matter how dispirited or uncommunicative, if you create the right conditions and give them a chance, they typically make good progress. And so that was very heartening to see.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you tried to use that in your work in the legislature as well. Were you able to use some of the facets from the mediation training in your work there in the legislature?
Yeah, I did. And some of it was pretty subtle. At least I like to think it was pretty subtle. And some of it was quite overt, that sometimes it was the case that my boss, who was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, would literally say to me, "Doug, take these guys," and at that point they were mostly all guys, "back to my office and don't come back until you get this thing worked out." So, and fortunately at that point, I guess in the mid to late 80s, in the Texas legislature, the legislators were no longer allowed to carry guns.
Uh-huh, that was
the
good.
State capitol. There was a rule that was put in place not too many years beforehand. But it really helped in that case, as is the case with large public kind of endeavors, to have an ultimate decision maker, to have some pressure for parties to work together to try and accomplish a solution.
Yes. Well, I know that then you decided to take the leap and start your own business. What are some of the things that you did to initiate the process of starting your own facilitation firm?
Well, it's hard to start your own business. In fact, I do a training once or twice a year for MCDR, an organization that I've done a lot of work with, on how to start a business and how to write a business plan. And one learning from my experience is that if you've never started a business, then you don't know how to start a business. And so I stumbled around, but I did the same kind of thing I try and do all the time. I did research. I built a very broad network among practitioners. And I just kept bugging folks to give me more information, to supply me more names. And eventually when just before my wife and I moved from Texas to Baltimore, I was involved in a big national consensus building project and on energy strategy, national energy strategy consensus building project. And so I actually had a job when I started my consulting activity. And I thought it would go on for a while. I would not have moved to Baltimore if I didn't think I had a job. But then after doing that for about 6 months or 8 months, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and all bets were off, and the project was dead. And so I just moved my family to Baltimore, and I had to make a choice about whether I was going to jump in with both feet and make a consulting practice work, or whether I was going to abandon the enterprise and try and find a job somewhere. But I decided I'd go for it, and I'm happy I did.
Yeah, that must have been a little bit scary at the time.
It was very scary at the time. And looking back on it, I would say I really underestimated the risk I put my family at.
I know that you now do a lot of work leading collaborative processes with regard to federal policy. Can you explain something for people who don't know what that process looks like? Can you explain in a sort of concrete way what you do in that regard?
Okay. Well, it's lots and lots of different kinds of processes. What comes to mind for me is a colleague I haven't talked to for years, a guy named Tom Colosi, who created years ago this huge matrix of many, many, many different, dozens of different processes. So many of us, many folks on the call, are familiar with a mediation or mediative process. There are many variations in the mediative process. In the world of consultation and collaboration, which is where I work, there are just dozens of different variations, and they are to help with regulatory hearings. They help organize and facilitate planning processes and problem-solving processes and technology development and so terms like negotiated rulemaking, and there are just a panoply of different ways, different things to call these processes. But the main thing is that they run the full gambit between very formal to informal meetings. They can be large, they can be small, they can be very front-loaded, that is kind of early in the conflict formation cycle, or they can be very much at the tail end of the conflict spectrum where things are getting pretty ugly and tense. So what I, where I typically work, where I try to work is for, is to do early intervention. I try to focus in, as you said in your introduction, on conflict prevention kinds of activities. I think that's a productive place to work. And occasionally I do a very difficult mediation or conduct a really huge negotiation, but most of what I do is meetings and that are anticipating some federal regulation or anticipating the development of a technology or something like that.
So let's say the federal government is going to put into place a regulation. Who decides then who comes to the meetings that you are facilitating?
It's pretty much anybody who wishes to come can come.
Uh-huh.
All of these regulatory programs are required to provide notice to the public through the Federal Register.
Yes.
And there's typically a well-known cast of characters that show up for example, one regulatory program that I do a lot of work in is appliance energy efficiency standards. And so when you buy a new refrigerator or a new dishwasher, every one that is manufactured and sold in the United States needs to meet a minimum energy efficiency standard because Congress has determined that the United States has a key strategic interest in limiting oil imports and also diminishing electricity consumption where possible. So it's pretty open-ended. That is, anybody who can participate, anybody that wishes to participate can participate.
And so if you were doing that, anticipating regulation, and it was open to all, what would the goal of your meetings with them be? Would it be to come up with a joint recommendation? Would it be to gather information or something else?
Yeah, it's typically to gather information. Typically, there's a whole lot of research and analysis that's done for most of these regulatory programs. And most of the individuals that show up are what we'd call stakeholders. They're individuals that have an interest in the outcome that will be affected by the outcome. And they comment in great depth on the analysis, the work that's been done. And typically it's a multi-stage consultation process so that the government agency will push a draft preliminary analysis out for comment. And it can be very extensive and very detailed. The one meeting I did recently, there was what they call a technical support document. It was 580 pages long. And so all these individuals, all these parties that are affected, and it's both the environmentalists and energy efficiency advocates, for example, and all the manufacturers, they comment in great length. Then whatever the federal agency is, it considers all those comments and sends back a revised analysis and a different set of findings or proposals, and then another round of comment, and then typically a decision is made, a recommendation is made to the secretary of whatever or whomever, and then a decision is made.
Who makes the recommendation?
The staff makes a recommendation based
on the
input. Yeah.
The stakeholders then know that they're giving input. They know that they hope to affect the recommendation.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then there are other variants like negotiated rulemaking, for example, which
yeah.
I just did a negotiated rulemaking convening for a product. In the case of negotiated rulemaking, if the department decides to go forward with that, then they actually form what's called a Federal Advisory Committee Act committee, wherein they empower named negotiators to create a first draft of a federal regulation in the event all of the negotiators can agree on the terms of that proposed rule.
So in that case, your job as facilitator is to assist them in arriving at consensus. Is that
correct?
Right?
Correct. Yeah, and there's some other occasions when I'm really constrained by whatever the general counsel says about how far I can go to actually be mediative, to actually drive parties or encourage parties to have the kind of exchange that lead to an actual agreement.
Did you read that 580-page document, by the way?
No. Some of these folks work really, really hard. I mean, not only the staffers, but the All the stakeholders, there's a lot at stake here. Businesses can go in and out of business, plants close, a lot of things can happen. There's a lot of intense interest in what happens.
So the staff would be there to provide content knowledge, although you as a facilitator would need to be somewhat familiar with the situation and the terms. So
correct.
As not to hold people up, right?
Yeah, right. No, I try and get studied up. There's some pretty arcane stuff occasionally, but I was just looking at, I'm doing a meeting in December, and it's a technology road mapping sort of an engagement. And I'm just looking at the agenda sitting in front of me. And the first substantive discussion, it says, state of technology and standardization in integrated building diagnostic and control systems.
Wow.
Well, and so I'm not an engineer, and I don't know a heck of a lot about diagnostic and control systems, but I'm going to learn some stuff between now and then.
Right. So your view as to the question of should the facilitator have substance knowledge for the type of collaborative process that you do, which is certainly different from mediation, but you would feel you need to have some content knowledge at least in order to really conduct it.
It's a very big advantage, and there have been a few occasions, more than I wish to remember, where I didn't have much substantive knowledge, and I really didn't contribute as well as I should have.
Mm-hmm.
Once, or I guess maybe 10 or 15 years ago, there was a big problem surrounding some aspect of the Department of Defense on a weapons system. And I don't do any work in defense. Just dipped my toe in there once or twice in 20 years. So I was hired because folks knew me from other venues to do this engagement. And it was just all day long, all these acronyms I did not understand. And so I still made my small contribution, but I wasn't nearly as effective as I should have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once you're there, and you kind of have to go with what you have.
Yep.
So, Doug, what would happen if this let me back up. This facilitated process that you do, for example, in negotiated rulemaking, that is it a requirement that facilitated process occur?
No. No, the way that, just to zero in on negotiated rulemaking, which is one really wonderful form of creating a negotiation opportunity for all the parties, the way that typically begins is that you hire a mediator or two to do a convening report wherein the mediator assesses the viability, the prospect for a successful negotiation. And then if the convener decides that it's a good prospect, that it can work, then the report makes a recommendation to the department of whatever, and then the department considers its options. I should say that the people that I work with in Washington, they're constantly considering their many different options, their BATNAs, if you will,
mm-hmm.
so that if they don't think that they're going to get the right answer from Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Energy, then they're assessing what their best prospects are going to be the next time there's a bill before Congress. And there's a lot of back and forth and kind of handicapping and trying to figure out where the best place to make the gains they want to make might be. It's very politicized.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering at this point, I definitely have more questions, but I'm wondering if there are people on the line who have some questions. Is there anyone who would like to ask Doug a question at this point?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Craig Distelhorst, Doug. On your subject matter issue that you discussed, that you're going in with not a lot of background, although you tried to develop it before the facilitation, what sort of discussion do you have relative to your client as to what background you might or might not have?
Well, I think you owe it to your clients to disclose how much or how little you know, and if you're fortunate, as I am, I've tried to be, as a business survival mechanism, I've tried to be very sort of niche-focused so that I do virtually all of my work at the intersection of energy and environment. And I, unless there's some really good reason, or unless the well is really dry, I don't do work in other domains. And what I've observed as a business practice is that if you're well established in a niche and you haven't got enough work in that niche, you're better off trying to figure out some way to get more business within that niche than to go out and stomp around in some other domain that you know so little about.
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions from people who've been listening?
Yes, I've got a question. This is Mike Aaron in Baltimore.
Thank you.
Sure. You mentioned that you had the weapon system negotiation that, in retrospect, you were not able to contribute as much as you thought you could have or should have. After the fact, that is looking back from now, what would you have done differently, given your knowledge that that probably wasn't the best thing for you to be doing?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's always... Well, as a professional, you need to make sure, as best you can, that you have the prospect for you and for the entire group to succeed. So sometimes that means that you need to build in time in the contract, for example, to do preparation. That sort of thing. But in that case, it's a pretty full spectrum of effectiveness among facilitators and mediators, in my experience. Most of the time, people that are in a difficult negotiation or a difficult problem-solving setting are very, very happy to simply have an effective meeting. They don't need you to be a substantive expert. If you know the subject matter well, it really makes a big difference. But I would say the majority of the facilitation that I see, not that I do, but that I see around, is just doing an effective meeting. That means establishing a good agenda, making the participants comfortable, creating some sort of a process that has the potential to yield results, creating shared airtime, doing a lot of really fundamental meeting management kinds of things well, and most people are really happy to have that.
I want to just remind people again, because some people have come on the line since we started, that you should not put this call on hold. That would mean that your on-hold music would be heard by everyone else. We recommend that you hit *6 if you're not asking a question, because that will mute your line so that any background noise doesn't come through. Just wanted to mention that for new people who've come on the line. Other questions for Doug at this point? And if you would say your name at the beginning as the last caller did, that would be helpful also.
Yeah, this is Joe Siegel in New York. I wonder if you could offer any thoughts you have on lessons learned regarding breakout groups and when they're most effectively used and how to use them and most effectively.
Okay. Well, that's a good question. In fact, the other questions were good questions also. Well, typically you would use breakout groups in my world in the context of a negotiation. That's not quite true. In regulatory processes, most of the regulatory processes that I get engaged in are fairly formal. That is, there's typically a court reporter and a full transcript of what goes on. So that does not lend itself toward having smaller groups of individuals take up a content area and work on it. However, if you're doing, for example, a technology roadmap that involves integrating several different technology streams, that sort of thing, then in planning processes, there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration. I think the main thing about breakout groups is that you need to design the output from the breakout groups carefully so that when the group returns and they do some sort of a report back, that the pieces have the potential to fit together gracefully. And I would offer also that frequently the report back by a breakout group is the least appreciated part of any given meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it's hard to make them go efficiently, and breakout groups need to be managed effectively just like big meetings do. So you always, pardon me, always need to designate a facilitator, always need to have a really clear agenda for them to follow. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's helpful. I often find that it is the dullest part of a meeting, and and getting the information to kind of get streamlined into the overall goals is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, you addressed that. I'm wondering if there's any particular thoughts you have on how to make sure that happens in a successful way.
Well, so you can go a long way toward making them be effective by really dipping deep, pardon me, in the meeting design. You need to make sure that the participants really understand the deliverables for the breakouts and the larger meeting and how these pieces fit together. You can even do things like having roles established in the breakout. You can have someone who's the designated technical expert, someone who has other kinds of roles. You certainly want to make sure you've got someone who's the note taker, recorder. And you want to specify clearly the nature of the report back, the nature of the output. So when I do breakouts, they typically get a couple of pages of agenda and instructions and the like. And the facilitator of each of the breakout groups, we have a facilitator's meeting in advance, so it's clear what they're trying to accomplish.
And are you able, and as a follow-up, Doug, to make it be that their reports are interesting to everyone?
It's very hard to do. And you need to be respectful, so you can't just, like, cut people off and, that sort of thing. However, to really clarify expectations at the front end, even when you first introduce the agenda at the very beginning of a meeting, that is, okay, you only got 5 minutes now. Is that going to work? That sort of thing. And creating clear expectations and clear understanding about what's to be accomplished or delivered, that's what saves the day typically. But it's something of a wild card. Another thing that I typically do that can help is in the breakout groups that I run or that I have when I do big meetings where there are a lot of breakout groups, I make sure that the person who is going to be presenting or person or two that's going to be presenting the output from the group, that person is kind of nominated rather than simply selected by default. I want to make sure that someone strong, someone who is an effective spokesperson for that group is going to be standing up and delivering the information.
Sounds like you carefully think out a lot of the details of the process that you use.
I do, and sometimes I lose sleep over it. I kind of obsess. I'm doing a project on Tuesday, and it's a very complicated situation in a federal agency client of mine. And I've been spending, I can't say how many hours, I've been trying to wrap my brain around the dynamics enough to come up with of the flow of this meeting that's going to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have other questions, but I want to make sure that people have the opportunity. So let's continue with questions from the group. If you would say your name and ask your question, go ahead.
Sandra Brantley from Maryland. Doug, I would like to know that to do this mediation for the government, do you have to submit any type of bid or proposal?
It varies a lot. Frequently, these jobs or these activities are competitively bid. In some cases, I've been working with these clients for a long time, and I don't have to competitively bid those, but it's a very common thing to have to bid on processes and sometimes on jobs. And sometimes there's some simple guidance that's been issued. A federal agency or two now will say, okay, you have discretion to hire a facilitator. They never call them mediators, by the way. I think that it would be indicative of admitting defeat on the part of these senior governmental officials. But every different agency, and I've worked with all the agencies in the federal government that deal with energy and environmental policy and technology advancement, I think, they all do it differently. They all have different standards. They all have a different way of doing business. And that's another reason, as a business development activity, that you want to have a kind of a fairly narrow sort of a focal point for your work.
Doug, as a follow-on, the caller may also wonder, how do you find out about the RFPs for such bids?
they're available in many different places. If you're lucky, with, for example, BizOps, I think, is a website. If you had the endurance, you could actually scan through the Federal Register. I'm sure that there are listservs where you could do keyword search for facilitation services or planning services and the like. Mm-hmm. And I would say, as a general matter, there's a lot more facilitation and what I would call mediative sorts of interventions. I consider myself an intervener, mm-hmm. and what that means to me is that whatever you encounter when you show up on the site, you got to figure out what would be a productive thing to do. And there's a huge variation on the kinds of situations you face as an intervener.
Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with the WEOP site for proposal, request for proposals and all, but I didn't know how they would put it there. Would it be, like you say, a facilitator or mediator or ADR or what?
Yeah.
Arbitrator,
You may have the capacity to do a keyword search, and those words would all work. I think facilitator, it's seldom, unless you're doing most of the kind of work that I do, which I'd be under the label of facilitator or moderator or a consultant or technical assistance or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Please say your name and go ahead and ask your question.
Joyce Mitchell. Greetings, Doug and Ramona. How are you both?
Good. Thanks,
Joyce. Good.
Good. Doug, I would like to know, typically, how many people might be on your team? And generally, how long do your facilitations of some of these rulemaking circumstances happen? How long is it?
Well, there are many different variations on the, for example, on federal rulemaking. Typically, at a place like the Department of Energy, it takes a full 3 years to get something done, two or three years. And there's typically two or three meetings on every different product. But that gets strung out over a span of time. And there's a big variation in how many people are involved and the like, but it's typically the case that there are 50, 60, 70 people in these big public hearings. And then you have other much smaller internal organizational meetings that happen, for example, if you're doing planning activities or technology development meetings or something like that. Did that answer your question?
No, I was trying to figure out how many might work on your team as facilitators, mediators.
I knew there was something I forgot there. Well, for the regulatory meetings, typically I'm the only facilitator. Sometimes I do a big meeting in Washington for like the White House or somebody like that, and they're going to bring together, say, 500 or 1,000 people to create policy options or to create some sort of impetus to get something done, in which case I guess I've and then I manage a very, very large team of individuals, and that typically could be 5 or 10 facilitators that are going to be doing breakout sessions and as well as a recorder and that sort of thing. But most of what I do these days is just me. And if for example, we're doing some sort of a planning activity, then I take the talent that's going to be there at the meeting and give them a quick training in facilitation skills. Most of them are real smart and they're very communicative, and they can do the job quite sufficiently. And so the trend these days is I seldom hire a professional team, but when I do, I always enjoy it because I get a better outcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joyce. Next question. Just indicate your name and your question. Okay, well, let me ask a few more questions, and then there may be some from others. What are the challenges in your job, and what are the joys in your job, Doug? That's a big question.
I better write down the word joys so I don't forget it. Well, the challenges are many, and really there are different challenges in each job. And I do a very broad spectrum of different kinds of things within this niche that I've described. However, I would say the basics remain pretty much the same. That is, you're working to engender trust on the part of all the parties involved. You're working to create and shape a doable agenda. As I said before, the content can get pretty darn specific or arcane. For example, if I was doing technology development roadmap for solid-state lighting, which is essentially chip technology, and gee, I tell you, I don't know much about chip technology, but I sure learned a lot about it in a hurry because it was a requirement to conduct a real conversation about how you prioritize among many, 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 many different pathways to achieve some goals. And sometimes, frequently it's the case, since I work in the federal sector a lot, that I'm working inside what I call big systems. That is, it's multiple layers of a large agency. So you're dealing with the secretary's office and the assistant secretary and a bunch of senior staffers, and you know, you work your way through this hierarchy. And it's frequently the case that you need to do conciliation, or you need to mediate among these individuals to even establish what it is you're trying to accomplish. I've recently done a few big international meetings that were initiated by the president or the secretary of something, and there's a big, big difference in the way the Canadians view energy and environmental policy than the way the Americans do. So it can be quite mediative before you ever get in the room to have a meeting.
Mm-hmm. And what about the joys?
Oh, yes. I knew I'd forget that. Well, I have to say, it's a joy to do this work. It's a joy to feel like you're being productive. It's a joy to work for yourself. And I just feel absolutely blessed to be in the position I'm in. I work with really smart people. Sometimes they really challenge me. And I have the greatest respect for especially the senior federal folks that I work with, who are some of the most talented people you would ever meet, who put up with all kinds of, shall we say, difficulty to do their jobs and do them well. And so it's a really great cadre of individuals who are really trying to do something useful for this country, and I just feel proud to be a part of it.
That's interesting. You know, there are people who are very angry at the government, thinking that they're not really working hard or doing their job, and you're saying that from your experience with them, you really are impressed by their abilities and endeavors.
I promise you, this is a dedicated, the folks I work with, dedicated, smart, hardworking, and they are no drag on the taxpayer dollar. They are really cranking.
Mm-hmm. Now, if somebody, Doug, wanted to get into the field at this point in time, maybe they have some mediation background, but what you're doing is different from that. What kind of advice would you give them at this point?
Well, my friend Larry Susskind years ago said, well, there are meetings everywhere. Figure out a way to start facilitating them. And so that's a start. And I would say that making the transition from mediation to large group, large scale facilitation can be quite, there's a lot of difference between the two, but the fundamental skill sets that you bring are those of a mediator.
There are a lot of,
for example, other professionals that facilitate meetings that don't know what to do with conflict, that haven't got the refined communication skills, that don't have the fundamentals that most mediators have acquired, and they don't do as well in these large meeting contexts. But you're just talking about running a big meeting with 100 or more individuals, paying a lot of attention to the design of the meeting itself, that is the actual step-by-step-by-step process that you're going to go through during the span of a day or two. Those are the things that you gain with experience, and you just need to find a way to, and there's some good training programs also. I probably said that too quickly. There aren't that many good training programs, really,
mm-hmm.
but there's some really good books. Sibbett's got a really good book. There are a bunch of good books. If you go to the Josie Bass website, 20 years ago when I started doing this, full-time, actually 25 years ago is when I started doing this, there wasn't a lot that was written on the subject, and now there are lots of good books.
And once they've done that, though, they still have to find clients. And when you started out, you said you found clients by calling lots of people and asking for connections. So what kind of advice would you give people now as to how to find clients in today's climate?
Well, this is kind of a business development question, and it's a big topic. What I would say is that most of us find clients in a subject matter area that they know. So when I graduated from graduate school in Texas, I was essentially an energy economist for a number of years. So I guess it's not much of a surprise that my knowledge of energy and the regulatory stuff surrounding it and all that became very useful, and that now the Department of Energy is one of my biggest clients.
Mm-hmm. So one thing you would suggest is for them to look at what their subject matter expertise is and then look in that arena to offer their facilitation skills. Is that right?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
By the way, there's some
Can
feedback.
I ask a question?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi, Doug. This is Nick White.
Hi, Nick.
So you've been, in this field for 25 years now. I'm curious from your perspective, a lot of different people, practitioners, researchers have, wondered about institutionalization. So I'm curious, where would you say the federal government is around these processes? Do you think in some agencies it is a part of the normal routine that they will turn to these services, or is it still something that agencies are experimenting with? I'm just curious on your perception of the growth of this field and how integrated it's become into government.
Yeah, well, integration's a hard word to incorporate here. I would say that the different administrations come in and they have different perspectives on collaboration, and some are up for it and see the utility and benefit, and others are just absolutely against it. I've prospered by making sure I had a bunch of senior federal clients and also having a bunch of political clients, so that I've tried to create a balance in who wants services. But I have this quote on my bulletin board. I'm looking at it. It's a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, and he says, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And that's the way I see this work. I think that the larger arc is very positive. It's now the case, and it sure wasn't the case 20 or 15 years ago, a lot of places where I work, they won't have a big meeting without having a professional facilitator, or at least someone very capable in that designated role. And I think that there's been a lot of experience with different mediative sorts of or facilitative sorts of interventions, and so these parties, they like it. They have a good meeting. They get what they need to say out on the record or in as input to some governmental enterprise, and as a contribution to decision-making processes, collaboration is far superior than something that's more adversary. So occasionally it's the case that some individual or some group has enough power to run over top of everyone else. But shortly, typically the tables are reversed, and then they wish they'd negotiated. And so I'd say that the larger arc is very good, and some institutionalization that is taking place. There are more and more firms in Washington and I guess around the country that are doing this kind of work, facilitating and mediating, especially in the environmental arena. And I think that smart federal officials, the ones who are charged to do regulation and to affect outcomes in the public interest, they see that having a third-party neutral who's capable makes a big difference.
Other questions? Please just say your name and ask a question.
Yes, this is Chandra again. Doug, as a professional facilitator, do you actually take the notes, or is there someone else taking notes? And who writes up what's being said or what is being agreed to or what's going to be done?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and it varies a lot. Typically, it varies by context. if it's a formal hearing kind of a setting, there's literally a court reporter or someone making a tape recording, and they produce a word-by-word transcript that's posted on the website, the DOE website or the EPA website or whatever. If I'm doing a planning meeting, it depends on how we figure out the roles in advance. If I do a very complicated planning meeting, then typically I'll hire a note taker to take detailed notes, but I'll always be scribing on flip charts there in the front of the room, and that would be sort of a shorthand, kind of a table of, well, more than that, kind of table of contents plus additional, plus additional comments sort of running capture of the information. I seldom write a big report. It's mm-hmm. typically the case if I hire a note taker that I'll edit the meeting summary to make sure that it reflects what I think was said.
Other questions? Please say your name and ask your question.
This is Mike Aaron one more time. Hi, Doug. You were talking about your experience at the Texas legislature, and you said something to the effect of when an effort failed that you thought it was because of a lack of effective facilitation and that there was no one who would step in to offer a solution from A to Z. And those two comments, which I'm interpreting from my own memory, obviously, but those sort of point to different skill sets, mm-hmm. one being a facilitator, one being sort of a public planner.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of elaborate on that a little bit and sort of discuss where the role of facilitation ends and the role of planner begins?
Yeah, and I guess I kind of combined a couple of concepts there in short form. You've made a good distinction there, I think. In the legislative context, what I observed was that occasionally you had the chairman of some committee who was very adept at listening hard to the different viewpoints and finding a way to kind of wrap them together, to find a third way or to encourage the kind of exchange that got people off their most stark position and caused them to start exploring interests. In the legislative context, it's frequently the case that the products are overdeveloped, in fact, quite well developed, and it's a matter of choosing between a whole variety of different options that are already on the table. So in that respect, it's not like planning, but it's a matter of political accommodation, compromise, and all that kind of thing. There's a huge room for facilitative intervention or mediative work in all kinds of planning processes, and I think increasingly following Nick's earlier question about how these processes are being embraced or institutionalized, used more frequently, I think that participatory planning that engages citizens or stakeholders in just so many different venues, it's becoming more and more not only useful but necessary to get things done.
Other questions?
Dave, Craig, just a horse. You were involved in a facilitation of a group of people that would be meeting together in the future. That would be meeting together in the future, and you're under a fixed cost contract with them, which they can't afford to pay more than. And it's an all-day facilitation, and you reach the end of the day, have gone over a bit, and they've got everything done, but they're down to a final point that they can't quite agree on. It doesn't really look like they're going to be able to agree on it without sleeping on it some more, although it's been an issue that's been bothering them for some time. How would you handle that?
Well, you need to make a choice about as a professional, and you need to make a decision about where you think the group is surrounding closure. As a professional that does this work, if you get hired to do the work, it's kind of, what's that phrase, in for a penny, in for a pound. If it takes some exceptional effort and you haven't secured a contract that's big enough to fully fund your effort, then probably you still got to see it through as best you can. At least I try to. However, I should say as a business development matter, I try to make sure the contracts that I write are sufficient, although I occasionally miss like everybody else, but because it's hard to anticipate the amount of effort. But once you're in it, your reputation hinges on your ability to deliver some useful product to all these parties. I say product, that is, what you do as an intervener has got to be sufficient to do a good job. And then the other point I was making was that over time you develop something of an intuition surrounding how ripe the movement toward agreement is, how much it portends success, how much you're moving away from it. So at a minimum, at the end of the day, when you've got that one issue that's still not done, you need to establish the process looking forward to move towards concluding that final issue. And that's typically sufficient. And you will have executed, I believe, your professional responsibility to that group if you can establish a pathway that seems viable to the group. And so that's what, at a minimum, that's what I always need to do, and even if you have to stay late to get it done.
Doug, you had told me at the beginning that you needed to stop promptly because you have another commitment at 1.
Yep.
So although there may be other questions, I am going to bring this to a close at this point. Thank you for talking. I have found it fascinating, really, and I think other people probably have as well. Our listserv will indicate what number people can call to listen to this, and it will subsequently be on our website. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks, Ramona. Thanks for being my interlocutor.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Doug.
Bye. Thank you, Doug.